Welcome to episode 40 of The Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and each week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. This week's guest is Vinton Cerf, Vice President and Chief Internet Evangelist at Google, and considered the co-father of the Internet. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. Google's mission is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful, and is committed to significantly improving the lives of as many people as possible. Since being founded in 1998, Google has grown from two computer science students in a university dorm room to tens of thousands of employees with offices all around the world. Google believes that technology can be used to help address the biggest issues facing humanity, and that climate change is a pressing global issue that poses an imminent threat to our planet, and that clear, immediate action must be taken on a global scale if the impacts of climate change are to be mitigated and, ideally, reversed. Google has a long-standing commitment to climate action and environmental stewardship. Sustainability has been a core value since Google's founding, and they strive to build sustainability into everything they do. In 2018, Google achieved 12 consecutive years of carbon neutrality and, for the second year in a row, matched 100% of the electricity consumption of their global operations with renewable energy. Google also announced a long-term goal to power their operations with carbon-free energy 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Over the next couple of weeks, please don't miss more exciting guests on the Climate Champions, including Tim Sassine, Business Development Manager at Ballard Power. He's seriously into the carbon mitigation potential of hydrogen. And Larry Peranich, a retired expert in predictive analytics, a highly active volunteer with Citizens Climate Lobby, and a lifelong Republican trying to move the party forward with regard to climate change mitigation. And if you want an unprecedented opportunity to connect with key stakeholders and explore what's next in the utility sector, join me at GridConnect in Washington, D.C., December 10th through 12th. I'll be recording an episode of The Climate Champions live the morning of the 10th, followed by world-class experts exploring diverse perspectives and uncovering market innovations poised to redraw the electric utility landscape. Secure your spot at GridConnect by registering now at GridConnect, that's an X instead of a C, .com. Vint and I met almost 10 years ago, keynoting an event in downtown San Diego. Vint, because of the impact he's had and will have on the world, and me because I live close by. We discussed the future of self-driving vehicles, which seemed like science fiction to me, but Vint was all over it. In 1973, Vint co-designed with his partner, Bob Kahn, the Transmission Control Protocol, Internet Protocol, better known as TCP/IP, a set of networking protocols that allow computers to communicate, basically the Internet. Vint was presented the U.S. National Medal of Technology by President Bill Clinton and the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President George Bush. He also co-founded the Internet Society and served as president of ICANN, the operator of the domain naming system. And in case you're wondering, Vint Cerf got national medals from Presidents Bush and Clinton, but had me call him Vint, not the more formal Vint. Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat. I'm sitting down here at Google in Washington, D.C. with Vint Cerf. He's the VP and Chief Internet Evangelist at Google. Welcome to Climate Champions.
Well, thank you so much. This is a real opportunity to have what I hope will be a substantive discussion.
I hope so, too. With regard, well, you know, that's going to depend on me, but it's also going to depend on you. So with regard to climate change, what was your motivating moment that brought you in as someone that wants to mitigate climate change?
Well, ironically, it's Al Gore. Many people will know that or imagine somehow that Al claimed, you know, parenthood for the Internet. And just to clear this up, he actually helped a whole lot but it was on the legislative side, helping to fund the National Research and Education Network, which expanded internet through the National Science Foundation.
Policy is important too.
Policy is very important, and he also helped to pass legislation that allowed commercial traffic to flow on the government-sponsored backbones, particularly like the NSFNet or the NASA Science Internet or the Department of Energy ESNet. He really had a very important role to play. But in 1986, when he had a hearing on this topic of what we call national information infrastructure, he also published a book called Earth and the Balance. And so that was my first introduction to his concerns about global warming. Since that time, of course, he's done many things, including winning the Nobel Prize and producing two movies, documentaries on the topic. I won't call it regular, but I will say sporadic, but frequent interactions with Al, mostly online, and follow a lot of what he's doing. I'm a huge proponent of what he's been trying to do, which is to educate people not only about the problem, but also about steps that we can take to mitigate it. There's no doubt in my mind right now that we will not be able to prevent some of the bad side effects.
Bad side effects are already happening.
That's correct. And so we won't be able to stop that, but at least we can anticipate what some of the problems are. And I expect as we get into our conversation, we'll be able to explore some of those ideas.
I have to just point out that a few hours ago, I sat down and talked to Catherine Hamilton. And when I asked her motivation, she mentioned the same book by Al Gore, Earth and Balance.
So Al deserves enormous credit. He was also one of the first elected officials to recognize the importance of the internet technology, partly because his father, Al Gore Sr., had introduced the Interstate Highway Act, which turns out it was a Defense Department bill. The idea was to build these interstate highways and then move the U.S. missiles, the ICBMs, around so as to avoid having them in fixed silos, which could be targeted by the Russians. So we built the highway system. We never actually moved the missiles around. We ended up with fixed silos anyway. However, in the course of building the interstate highway system, we triggered this gigantic boom, automobile production and suburban living. And so the result was this massive economic growth as a side effect. So he remembered that. And as the internet starts to creep up to radar visibility, he referred to that as the information superhighway, which I think was a reflection of his father's work on the interstate highway system. So Al got this very, very early on.
It reminds me, not the same thing, but it does remind me, I think it was in 1992, I was working at Tandem Computers in Silicon Valley.
Yes, those are the machines that never stop.
It really was a great piece of engineering at
yes,
the time
it
and really solved an industry problem. Stock markets and banks all over the world relied on nonstop tandem computing. I was on a team, and I think her name, it was a long time ago, Gwynne Franzino, I think was her name. She ended up going to Cisco, so that's a call out to her. But she recognized, I think in 1992, the value of the internet. And back then, I think Mosaic was the way you surfed the internet. It was no graphical.
Actually, it wasn't even quite there because Tim released his version of the World Wide Web around December of 91. The Mosaic version emerged somewhere in early 1993 out of the National Center for Supercomputer Applications. The reason I'm very conscious of this is that Bob Kahn and I started the Internet Society in 1992, January 1. And very shortly after I became president of that organization, I encountered the Mosaic browser. And of course, that just generated enormous amounts of excitement because for the first time, the internet suddenly looked like a magazine. It had, you know, formatted text and imagery and eventually streaming audio and video. Well, quite far distant from the text-based Unix command line mode of operation, which was its normal character up until that time. So that was a not surprisingly very dramatic moment for all of us.
Yeah, she said we should do frequently asked questions about the products we were releasing over the internet. No one knew what she was talking about, but she was totally right, and we did.
Wow. Cisco was one of the first of the router companies to take advantage of producing something that you could sell that was intimately associated with the internet. So it was one of the first commercialization steps. The only other company I can think of that was contemporary was something called Protean, and they were looking at high-speed local area networks, for example.
I think Tandem bought Ungerman Bass.
Yes, Ungerman Bass was another one of the companies that was deep into chipsets for these sorts of things. So that was timely.
Another guy on my team, I really do think it was very early, Jim Morrow. He looked at it as a way to, again, instead of doing a front end using traditional means, he insisted that one of the products that he was working on leverage the internet as the way that it had people enter data. It was an early application at Tandem, but it was fantastic for us.
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that.
Why is climate change mitigation personal for you?
Well, first of all, I have two grandsons now, and that's new. They're 1 year old and 3 years old. Then I imagine what's the world going to be like for them 20 to 30 or 40 years from now. We're now talking about 2050, 2060, and I think you know as well as I do that the projections are that many of the negative side effects of global warming will become intensely visible during that time frame. So I worry a lot about the world that we deliver to our descendants. There's a phrase, try to be a good ancestor, which I think might be stolen from John Perry Barlow, but it's apt in this case. What can we do to try to improve the world that, or at least reduce the negative consequences of our profligate use of carbon-producing energy sources? So I'm very concerned about that, to say nothing of what we can already see, and that's sort of the extreme weather events like the one that just happened, Dorian, which essentially wiped out the Bahamas or significant parts of it, and to say nothing of earlier hurricanes which have happened in the last several years. So there's no doubt in my mind that we're seeing some of the side effects. There's also some recent reports of a major warming trend in the Pacific heading towards the west coast of the U.S. Remember that climate and weather are very much an interaction between the atmosphere and the ocean. And those, it's a very complex system. It's not one that we necessarily fully understand. But the dynamics of both of those two reservoirs, so to speak, can lead to catastrophic consequences. And so we're already starting to see some of those. Just to give you another example, the ice that melts that's on land, not the ice that's on the ocean, but the ice that's on land, as it melts and runs off, it reduces pressure and weight on that landmass. Well, imagine that you look at this from the tectonic point of view, you would expect to see tectonic side effects as a result of the reduction in the weight of ice on land masses, especially in Antarctica, for example. So now we can anticipate potential tectonic side effects along the Ring of Fire. So there's just so many different parts of this ecosystem that are affected by climate change, dramatic changes, especially in the surface area of the ocean, where we're starting to see acidification, which will kill off some parts of the food chain. The consequence of that, of course, eventually affects us because we're at the top of that food chain. So it's hard to even estimate the far-ranging impact of climate change. Think about ocean rise. Think about the storm surge. Think about people living along the coastal regions. There are a couple hundred million people, at least, maybe more, living in coastal areas around the world. Those will become uninhabitable because they'll be underwater or they'll be subject to storm surge. Think about India during the monsoon season and in the hottest parts of the year. They are reporting extended periods of 50 degrees centigrade temperatures. That's lethal. That will be uninhabitable. In fact, there's a book I read recently called The Uninhabitable Earth. I'm sorry, the author's name escapes me, but I felt like I needed a change of underwear halfway through reading that book. So my reaction right now is that this is upfront and personal and will affect me and my family, to say nothing of the other 7 billion people that are on the planet.
So you saying things like that is why sometimes I can't sleep at night. When I do these interviews and we go over the known, very high confidence impacts that are going to happen or are already happening, I've accepted those. Mm-hmm. But whenever I delve into the other potential side effects that maybe aren't perfectly scientific backed up yet, so that there's some question about whether mm-hmm. it'll happen, but it doesn't get published as much or talked about when it doesn't have that strong scientific backing. But some of those are going to happen.
Well, look, I'll give you a couple more examples. We already have heard reports from the northern parts of Russia that the melting of the tundra is releasing not only methane, but it's also releasing pathogens that haven't been seen for a while. There was an anthrax release that was reported, for example. The next problem we end up with is that along the coastal regions, especially where we can't cope with the storm surge, we will be releasing sewage into the system we may potentially be polluting our aquifers. We may, in fact, see significant pandemics as a consequence of these various pathogenic releases. So you can see disease as well as effects on the food chain. How about desertification in places like the central parts of Spain? Rapid consumption of aquifers like the Oglala Central Aquifer in America's Midwest. It just goes on and on. And the fact that we don't fully understand all of the model dynamics of how these various systems interact should not deter us from understanding that there is high risk here. It's already very clear. And the question then is there anything we can do about this?
So before we answer that question, you said it's very clear, but I continue to run into people that they used to say there wasn't climate change. Now they're saying there is climate change, but that it's not human-made. What do you say to them to try to convince them otherwise?
Well, the first problem that you encounter is that if someone is determined to believe that it is not human caused, they will look for every possible argument to dissuade you or to discount any reports at all. So I recently read an article that tried to lay out an argument against human caused climate change, and it raised issues associated with the kinds of measurements that have been made about temperature and the claim that the results were being fiddled by the scientists who wanted to scare everybody and things like that. And I went to the best source I could. I won't tell you who because I promised I wouldn't, but a very, very senior person in this business who has a long track record. And he walked through that entire document step by step and showed why the arguments were slanted or simply misrepresented. So, for example, the one argument is, well, the temperature information is being collected in urban areas, and there's a lot of sunlight being reflected off of the tarmac, and therefore the data is all skewed. And the answer is, well, most of the sensors are in grassy areas to begin with, and it's well understood that there is an urban skew to the data. There are correction factors that can be legitimately made. Of course, the argument is, well, they fiddled with the data. And the answer is, yeah, we were trying to make sure that the data accurately reflects what's going on. So I don't honestly think that factual argument will work. In many cases, there is a confirmation bias. There is a almost tribal desire to ignore these results in order to justify practices that may be pecuniarily, if that's a word, beneficial to a person who wants to ignore the human-caused climate change, you know, the petroleum industry, for example. So rational argument doesn't seem to work very well. And at that point, you almost give up trying to convince people who don't want to believe it. And the best that I think I can do is to keep pressing on finding ways to respond, independent of the fact that some people may never be convinced that it's an issue.
I also have a desire to respond, but most of the people I talk to now doing these interviews and just in life are telling me to stop. It's wasting my time. If you don't understand what's going on now, you don't want to, and it's best to respond to the urgent situation we're in now.
Yes.
And start putting the effort into doing something about it instead of convincing.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. There are enough people who are conscious of the problem that I think we can do things. We won't actually stop the side effect of warming. We won't make it to the 1.5 or 2 degree limit. We will hit higher temperatures than that.
And there will be great impacts.
Yeah, there will be greater impact. And the thing that's important is that people who do care about this understand that when we talk about average temperature rise, that that's an average across the entire globe. There will be high dynamics in this. We're already seeing, for example, that the polar regions, especially in the north, are warming faster than the rest of the planet, which is leading to the melt of the tundra and all the side effects that we already talked about.
Yeah, the Scripps Institute in San Diego did some studies about where the temperature would increase the most, mm-hmm. where the rain would be less or more, and it's different for every region.
That's right. So any one response, for example, may turn out to work only for certain parts of the globe. An example, though, of things that we should be very concerned about will be the migrations away from areas that become uninhabitable, either because of temperature or lack of fresh water or disappearance underwater. All of those things will lead to migrations on a scale never seen before. Today, we believe we have like 60-some-odd million people who are refugees fleeing from conflict. that number will be dwarfed by the people who will flee from uninhabitable parts of the world. And now we have to ask ourselves, how on earth are we going to cope with that?
Yeah, what's our plan?
How do we absorb, you know, larger numbers of people, you know, to save them from destruction?
Can you talk about what you do at Google and in your non-Google life to help mitigate climate change?
So at Google, I do not have a specific responsibility for climate change. So it's an avocation from my point of view. I am the chief internet evangelist, and my work is largely to get more internet built all around the world. It was suggested to me by the former chairman of the board that I couldn't retire because I'm only half done. The current estimates are about 50% of the world is online and the other 50% is awaiting connectivity.
So does that mean you have to double your years of life from where it is
now? Well, hopefully not. However, I'm getting a lot of help from people all around the world who recognize the utility of the internet and who go to a lot of trouble to build more infrastructure. But I spent a lot of time going around the world talking to governments and the private sector about the choice of policies that would encourage more investment in the infrastructure that supports the internet. And then that's necessary because there are some governments who are afraid of the internet, who they see some of the negative effects of access to online material, especially in the social media.
Yeah, privacy and security, yeah, I think, all are the, huge
all
issues.
Of, yeah. All of the above. And so you find resistance. And it's not an unwitting resistance. I mean, there are some real problems that we have to solve. In the meantime, though, we all who have experienced the internet and used it, made use of Google's products and services, know how much value there is in the sharing and discovery of information and the ability to coordinate research and to coordinate other activity. So my job at Google is tangentially associated with climate change. But my work outside of Google, which Google thankfully permits, involves people-centered internet as an organization that I chair. And they're focused on how do we make the internet more useful for everyone. It's not just a question of putting equipment in place. It's figuring out what content can be made available, what applications are available, what can governments do to provide government services effectively through these online systems. There's another organization called Innovation for Jobs, and it's all about understanding how innovation and jobs are related. New innovations destroy old jobs and create new ones, but the implications are that the people whose jobs may have gone away now need to be retrained to do new jobs. The more important point here is that assuming we live longer, and the statistics are that kids born today may live to be 100, means that their working lives could be 70 or 80 years. The implication of that is that you can't learn enough in the first 20 to 25 years of your life to be productive for the remainder of your life. You're going to have to keep learning new things. So we have to teach people how to learn. We have to teach people to want to learn, and we have to provide them mechanisms for learning that are not causing them to drop everything and go back to school on a permanent basis or on a full-time basis. We need to provide education at need. And actually, I'm quite impressed by YouTube. It's not intended to be a commercial at all. I mean, literally, when you want to find out how to do something, it's extraordinarily surprising to find out somebody's already shot a video showing you how to do whatever it is. And so, you know, how do I do X? And bam, there's 17 videos waiting for you.
Admittedly, that is how I learned to do the podcasting, all with YouTube videos.
I am not surprised to hear this at all. For a while, I heard that younger people were turning to YouTube to get answers to questions of how do I. And I thought, oh, they should have been using Google search. Well, I now appreciate that why a lot of people have turned directly to YouTube, because there is so much content available. There is one other big issue here, and that it's not about global warming as much as it is about misinformation and disinformation, which is flying around the net, some of which is related to global warming or climate change. We have to learn how to think critically and seriously about what we see and hear, because there is content of little value in addition to content of high value, and we have to distinguish between the two. Teaching people to think critically about what they see and hear is another part of the, I would say, the responsibility that you inherit for the benefit you get from being online. And so people have to recognize that. I do have several other activities. I just stepped down from a seat on the National Science Board, which oversees the National Science Foundation. I had a 6-year term there. That was a wonderful opportunity to see what the $7 billion a year National Science Foundation was investing in terms of basic curiosity-driven science. And so that's just a thrill to be part of that activity. I also spend time with another organization I chair called the Marconi Society, which is focused on recognizing people whose contributions in the technology of communications, in the application, and the both job creation and humanitarian contributions to communications, that the organization recognizes individuals with a fellowship every year, plus young scholars who are just beginning their careers. I haven't been a participant directly in Al Gore's programs, Climate Change Education. I absorb that, but I just haven't found time to actively participate in those programs. But I'm a big fan and advocate for them, even though I haven't been as active as I suppose I should be.
Well, hopefully by doing this podcast, we'll get the word out even more.
I appreciate that.
Can you talk about your prior background?
I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, just north of Los Angeles, so I'm a Valley boy. I went to high school in Van Nuys, California. I went to Stanford University as an undergraduate in mathematics, worked at IBM for a couple of years in LA as a systems engineer, realized that I needed to learn more about computer science from the academic point of view, did a PhD at UCLA in computer science, rejoined the faculty at Stanford University for 4 years, where I started work on the internet design with my partner, Bob Kahn, then was pulled back to the East Coast, literally 46 years ago, in 1973, to run the internet research program and adjacent programs for the 6 years that I was at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And then in 1982, I left government service and joined MCI to build something called MCI Mail, which is a commercial electronic mail service, which eventually was interconnected with the internet. Then I joined my partner again, Bob Kahn, with his company, the Corporation for National Research Initiatives. And from 1986 to 1994, we did a variety of research programs, you know, digital libraries and other applications of the internet. Then MCI said, would you come back and put us in the internet business? And so I agreed to do that. We built two networks, the MCI Net, which is a commercial service, and the Very Broadband Network Service for NSF. As academic network to help support universities still interested in doing network research. And then around 2005, I sent a note to my good friend, Eric Schmidt, who then was the CEO of Google, asking if he wanted any help. And he sent a note back saying yes, and that was my job interview. So I've been at Google since 2005.
Well, that was a nice summary of a very long career doing many great things. Did you have any setbacks along that career?
Oh, yes. I would say that the most dramatic period of time in terms of setbacks was from 1973 to about 1993, that 20-year period. There were other ideas floating around about networking, and they were in competition with the TCP/IP protocols that Bob Kahn and I started working on in 1973. So there was something called the Open Systems Interconnection Model. And just about the time that I was, while I was at ARPA, just standardizing or finalizing and freezing the TCP/IP protocols, the Open Systems Interconnection Model popped up in 1978. And for the next 15 years, there was a competition between the TCP/IP protocols and the OSI protocols, which eventually ended partly for, well, two reasons. First of all, a lot more TCP/IP was implemented and running while the OSI protocols were highly documented but less widely implemented. And I remember Bob Kahn and I started the Internet Society in 1992. And as the president, after having watched this 15 years or so of tension and competition between TCP/IP and OSI, I wrote to the National Institutes of Standards and Technology and asked if they would please evaluate TCP/IP and the OSI protocols in order to hopefully establish equivalence, that is to say that the government was telling everybody you have to use the OSI protocols. That was a requirement for acquisition because, after all, it was going to be an international standard. It was being standardized by the International Standards Organization. So lots of countries adopted the OSI plan, even though it wasn't available to purchase. So people were signing up for OSI and then using TCP/IP, but they were doing it sort of sotto voce. So I asked NIST if they would evaluate this with my Internet Society hat on. And a year later, the Blue Ribbon Committee came back and said, well, you know, this TCP/IP stuff and this OSI stuff look like they're pretty much equivalent. So it's okay if you decide to use TCP/IP instead of OSI. And so that was a significant reversal of the official U.S. government position, and this is also true elsewhere. Meanwhile, in other parts of the world, the academic community, which got its hands on TCP/IP largely through the Unix operating system, which ARPA had outfitted with TCP/IP through Berkeley, the Berkeley release of Unix was the thing that carried the TCP/IP infection everywhere. To say nothing of Sun Microsystems, it was also adopting open standards and 3Com, which was developing Ethernet, so we could see an NSF investing in the NSFNet, which, by the way, Al Gore helped to promote. So we saw this coalescence of all these various different skeins of yarn into a beautiful fabric called the Internet. So there was quite a long period of battle there. Every time a new technology came along, it was going to take over TCP/IP. So X25, which preceded TCP/IP and was widely used, especially in the financial community, and everybody said, well, you know, it will take over. And I said, no, we'll run the Internet protocol on top of X25. Then ATM came along, the asynchronous transfer mode, and they said, that'll take over. And I said, no, we'll run it on top. And then Frame Relay came along, and they said, that'll take over. And I said, no, we'll run IP on top of that. I finally concluded that IP will run over everything, including you, if you're not paying attention. And so I had a T-shirt made that says IP on everything, which I truly believe then and now that we can run that protocol on virtually anything that will carry bits.
So I asked for your setbacks, and I think that was the competition between OSI and TCP/IP. But I think you also answered a success you're really proud of, and that is the ultimate application of TCP/IP virtually everywhere.
Well, I had certainly did not anticipate this at the beginning of the work in 1973. Bob and I were just trying to solve a particular technical problem for the Defense Department, which had identified several different ways of doing packet switching, one with satellites, one with mobile radio, and one with the original ARPANET. And then nearby at Xerox Park, the Ethernet was developed all in the same general time frame in 1973. So Bob and I were trying to figure out how do you hook all these nets together, because the Defense Department wanted to use the networks for command and control. So we were focused on solving a particular engineering problem. It wasn't really until the early 80s, for example, as we turned the Internet on, January of 1983, that we began to see more potential. By 1988, we had commercial providers of equipment, Cisco Systems, for example, and later Juniper and others, on top of which we started to see services arising in 1989. Commercial Internet service started to happen in the U.S. among three different providers, PSINet, UUNet, and SurfNet out in San Diego. Over that period of time, it sort of dawned on me increasingly that this thing might actually have a global potential, and we could see the academic community in Europe and then later in Asia and somewhat later Latin America and today Africa, where these systems are evolving. Very important element in today's Internet, of course, is mobile communication. The smartphones introduced in 2007 in the form of the iPhone dramatically increased people's ability to access the Internet. And between that and Wi-Fi, which is radio-based packet switching technology, the Internet has become dramatically more accessible. And that contributes to its utility. And it's a very interesting thing to watch these mutually reinforcing things happen. The mobile phone, the smartphone, helps to get people access to the Internet. And so it's enhancing access. But the Internet makes the mobile phone more useful because it's got all this content out there. So there are millions of apps that run on the mobiles that take advantage of the Internet. So the two reinforce each other dramatically.
Watch me turn this into climate change discussion. Okay, right before your eyes.
All right.
I see the same thing with renewable energy and energy storage and electric vehicles. The cheaper you make renewable energy, the more you need storage, energy storage to store it. But the more that comes down and you have it, the more energy you want to produce that way because you can finally store it. Similarly with electric vehicles, they become a way to get more renewable energy out there. And if you charge at the right time, you end up with more renewable energy, more storage, and more electric vehicles.
So my wife and I have two Teslas, and so we're big fans of electric vehicles. Your point about storage is extremely important, so let me make a point for you. In particular, if we're going to use renewable resources, since they are episodic, we don't get sunlight continuously, we don't get wind continuously, we have to be able to store energy that's produced by those means until it's needed. And so energy storage becomes absolutely essential to the successful operation of renewable energy resources. Ironically, the same is true in communications. Packet switching relies on storage. And the way that happens is that...
Buffers, right?
Yes, exactly, buffers. And so if you have a high-speed connection on the gigabit side and you have a low-speed connection on the other side, you can't squirt the data out as fast on the slow side as you can receive it on the incoming side. So you need to store it temporarily. And if you didn't have memory to store the packets, you couldn't do packet switching. And in particular, you couldn't do it at differential speeds. So the wonderful thing about packet switching is it works at any speed, even in a mixed environment, as long as you can store it temporarily. Energy is the same way. So we need more research on high capacity, rapid charge and discharge energy storage capabilities in order to take advantage of episodically renewable energy.
I do think we also need long-term storage and short-term storage. Short-term storage, lithium-ion is doing a fine job on. It could get cheaper, certainly, but it's doing it well. But I think we also need a solution to long-term storage. So you're going to produce more solar energy during the summer than you are during the winter because there's more sun, and you need as much energy in many places during the winter, so you're going to need to do some kind of storage.
So here's a crazy thought. If you watched communications over the past two decades, one of the surprises, from my point of view, has been the rapid increase in undersea optical cables. It's just gigantic amounts of cable are in there. Imagine for a moment that we had a global electrical grid so that when it's summertime somewhere, we get an excess of sunlight and we transmit the power to the place where they're not getting as much. Now, that's probably a little nuts because I don't know what the physical requirements would be to carry any significant amount of energy that way.
There's a lot of NIMBY. And there's a lot of cost to doing that.
Yeah. So that may not be that path may not be the right one. It does raise interesting questions about satellite-based power generation because they're outside of the shadow of the Earth most of the time. And so the result is that they can generate power all the time. Then the question is, how do I get it down to Earth without frying the 747 that's flying through an energy microwave transmission?
But people are working on it.
They are working on it. So we do have some serious work to do in material science to deal with effective storage. On the long-term storage side, it's interesting to think about pumping water up a hill, for example, and then running a generator, or running flywheels or things like that. There's also some liquid battery technology, which I'm not expert at all, but it's more effective, perhaps, for large-scale storage than even lithium ion.
Mike Nigley, somebody I worked with at Sempra, he was actually the COO and president of the utilities. He is now the chairman of the board for ESS, a storage company, and it is liquid, and it's very interesting. I think the more hours you want to go, the cheaper it gets to move to that from lithium ion.
I think that's right. Of course, lithium is fairly dangerous material since it's hypergolic in the presence of water, for example.
During my interview, Mike made a point of saying you can drink the fluid. No, I'm not going to drink it, but he said that you could. I think there's potential for hydrogen that's made from solar energy and from excess solar energy.
Well, you and I might have a disagreement. The reason that I'm a little hesitant about the hydrogen technology is that you have to transport it or you have to store it. To store it effectively, you have to put it either in very cold environments or you have to put it under enormously high pressure. And by the way, it burns in oxygen. So I'm worried that the dangers of a hydrogen-based system exceed those of alternatives, including lithium ion.
I have a buddy, Tim Sassine. He keeps telling me hydrogen is going to make it and that the costs are coming down. Yeah. But I don't know. I have those same concerns that you have.
Yeah, I would be worried about transporting the hydrogen or trying to generate it locally. Nickel hydride is an interesting storage method for hydrogen. But I am not persuaded right now that that's the best path forward.
So those are some pretty exciting successes, and you talked about some setbacks. Do you have any others you want to highlight?
Well, I can remember an incident which I thought would end my commercial career. When I worked on the MCI mail system, I started in late 1982. Our target was September of 1983 to launch this online electronic mail service. And so the night before launch, I knew that they had booked $25 million worth of satellite communications and press and all kinds of other stuff. And part of the feature of the MCI mail system was that not only could you send electronic mail, but you could send telex messages, and you could also send postal mail messages. So the format of MCI mail included the ability to include a postal address or a telex number or even an email address of some system other than MCI mail, because we were thinking in terms of interconnection among other electronic mail services. In order to demonstrate the effectiveness of the MCI mail print capability, we were going to, in the announcement of the service, do something which was visibly timely, like what time is it and what watch are you wearing and some other things, so that we couldn't fake it ahead of time. Like pick somebody from the audience and describe what they're wearing or what time it was or something. And then send that as an email, including overnighting a printed version of it to the press. So that was the plan, to demonstrate what we could do that was different from the classic electronic mail system. And sometime like, I don't know, 6 or 7 p.m. of the day before launch, which was 9 a.m. the next day, the print system stopped working. And so I'm sitting here, you know, sweating bullets. The engineer who was responsible for it was on his honeymoon in Las Vegas. And I basically insisted that I had to talk to this guy. We pulled him out of whatever it was he was doing. To his credit, he managed to get the system back up and running before 9 a.m. But I was anticipating being summarily fired by the CEO of the company at the time if we had failed to get that working.
That is very funny, although I don't think the person on his honeymoon thought so.
No, probably not, although we owe him a lot, or I do personally anyway.
Yeah. Can you talk about your vision for the future, especially with regards to climate change, either in the U.S. or the world 10, 20, 30 years out?
It would be an overstatement to claim that I have vision in this space, but I have some hopes. One of them, of course, is to find ways of reducing our energy consumption requirement by becoming more efficient. It was quite interesting to look at energy use in California on a per capita basis and to notice that over the past 20 years or so, that the curve is flat per capita in spite of the fact that there has been significant growth in the population in California. Well, that in itself is significant. You know, using LEDs instead of other alternative light sources is an obvious thing to do. The introduction of electric cars may or may not help. It depends a lot on when they're recharged and what the sources of energy are. Google, for example, is very proud of the fact that it is green now, 100% green. But that doesn't necessarily mean on a minute-by-minute thing we're 100% green, because surge requirements cause us to draw on sources that are not necessarily clean. We compensate for that with carbon tax kinds of mechanisms. In the long run, we're hoping all of our energy can be produced in a renewable green way. Further investment in green energy sources and what we've already talked about, storage capability short-term and long-term, possibly improving the way in which our grids work, instead of having central power generation and distribution, a more distributed and modular energy grid may be very helpful for two reasons. The first one is that the failure of an energy source has a smaller impact if it's been modularized and, you know, decentralized. But the second thing is that we may be less vulnerable to a Carrington event. For your listeners who might not know or remember this.
Or for me.
There was in the mid-1800s, I think it was 1860-ish, there was a coronal mass expulsion from the sun. This is a huge source of electrons flying out of the sun, heading towards Earth. And when it hit Earth, the entire telegraph grid was wiped out because the wires acted as a giant antenna. And so if we were to experience a similar event today, the probability is very high that not only would the electrical grid be wiped out, but an awful lot of the equipment plugged into it would also be wiped out. And a lot of that equipment is extremely complex and sensitive computer-based stuff. Think about the Internet of Things that we're already, you know, it's an avalanche of programmable devices coming. They'd all get knocked out. And so there's a lot of concern that people have about space weather and being prepared to know ahead of time. The problem is the information propagates at the speed of light. And so the electrons may be a little slower than that, perhaps.
But not much.
But not much. So we might have 8 minutes of warning. And I'm not quite sure what we would do with those 8 minutes, short of telling everybody to disconnect everything instantly or shutting the entire grid down, purposefully shutting it down. The problem with shutting the grid down is that the wires are still there and the generation of electrical energy might still happen because the wires would pick it all up and propagate it. That's one thing to be very worried about. We are deliciously dependent on communications today, but we are even more dependent on power, on electrical power. And when the electrical power goes out, within a few days, you see the thin film of civilization crack very quickly. We should be deeply concerned about that.
In addition to that kind of event happening, you could have a security event happen that could take out the grid. You could have a weather event that takes out the grid.
Yes.
So having your own distributed source of energy that when things are fine, you have a federated network of microgrids. But when things are bad, you have your microgrid. That can be very effective in a number of situations.
Well, I confess to you that in my case, I have a 50 kilowatt generator in the backyard that runs on natural gas. And it's important to me because I have a couple thousand bottles of wine in my cellar, and I need to keep them cold during the summer especially. So even though people have chided me for using a natural gas generator, I'm very concerned about my wine.
Is there anything else you want to say before I wrap up?
Well, only that the people who are listening to this should really take it on themselves to understand more deeply the nature of climate change and its side effects, and to think more fully about what it means for them and for their children and grandchildren. What's a responsible way to be a responsible ancestor in the face of this particular problem and then do something about it?
And with that, I'm going to wrap this up. I'm going to wrap it up with a wrap. Oh, TCPIP1 OSI is gone, and you did it with your partner, Bob Kahn. Earth and Balance, again, once more, was referenced by you, written by Al Gore. You're a grandpa now. That's something new. You have grandkid one and grandkid two. The ice on the land has great weight, and the fact that it's melting can shift the tectonic plate. About the impacts that can happen, there's a dearth, and it's talked about in the book, Uninhabited Earth. When you talked about the impacts, you make me want to sneeze, because one of the potential impacts is more disease. From your career, you thought you'd have to bail because of the honeymoon incident with MCI Mail. You can solve almost anything like a Rubik's Cube, and you can learn it all on YouTube.
Wow, that is a truly amazing performance. Thank you.
Thank you.
I watched you do that literally on the fly. You didn't write it all down ahead of time. You were looking at that and generating the rhyming.
I just took word notes.
Extraordinary. That's extraordinary. I'm very impressed.
And thank you very much for sitting down and talking with me.
Not at all. It's a real pleasure. Appreciate it.
In last week's episode with Catherine Hamilton, recorded a couple of hours prior to Vince, she also mentioned Al Gore's Earth in the Balance as her motivating moment. I made a quick comment to her about Al Gore, which she responded to, and we moved on. I guess I had surfing on the brain. But it was fantastic to have Vint clear this up and bring up Al Gore's part in the history of the internet, which was, in fact, substantial. It was also fun moving in and out of analogies between the internet and energy. And we didn't really touch on the more commonly compared similarities between centralized versus distributed generation. And for those of you interested in the book that had Vinton searching for a new pair of underwear, the author of the best-selling The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming, is David Wallace Wells, published by Tim Duggan Books. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crevatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you're in San Diego and want to trade your concern about climate change for a few hours of some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates. And if you want a release from some of life's stress or just to improve your speaking skills, consider taking a workshop at an improv club near you. Vince's request at the end of the podcast was for listeners to take it on themselves to understand more deeply the nature of climate change and the side effects, and to think more fully about what it means for them and their children and grandchildren. What's a responsible way to be a responsible ancestor in the face of this particular problem and then do something about it? A number of my podcast listeners have asked what they can do to help mitigate climate change, and I've responded that they can get an electric car or an efficient hybrid, and if it's possible for them, put solar on the roof and support the climate strikes and climate-focused marches. But I think Vince's advice is the most important. Take the time to really engage. Get informed. The longer we take to mitigate this absolute crisis of our time, the worse it is going to be for generations to come. And once you get it, spread the word. Educate others. We can help not only by changing our own behavior, hey, at least replace your incandescent bulbs with LEDs, but by educating ourselves, spreading the word, and joining Vint to help mitigate climate change.